So I'm going to talk about simulating highly distorted black holes, which is work in collaboration with Larry Kidder, Harold Pfeiffer, and Saul Tikosky. And I'm going to be using the code that's the Cornell Caltech code and was written primarily by Larry Kidder and Mark Shield. So yesterday we had up here, well, we had our list of progress, which we then made our list of, I guess, potential work. But we also had a little discussion in the end about some side problems or what we could do besides doing the full binary black hole orbit right now. And my list of what we would like to see those side problems study would be problems that can solve, problems we can solve with resources we have today in some reasonable amount of time. I guess I'll leave it to the individual to decide what's reasonable. And the second thing is we'd like to see these problems have interesting physics. This was, I think, a comment made by Matt, which is difficult to give a colloquium on what I did to improve my gauge conditions and things like that, especially when we're talking about a Schwarzschild black hole. And finally, we also like to see side problems capture some elements of the complexity of the binary black hole problem itself. Now, when we were talking about this yesterday, we were saying there's lots of things you can do in axisymmetric lower dimensions, and this is still certainly true. But what I would like to say or contend is that a highly distorted black hole can also be one of these problems, be such a problem, especially for the code that we're using, and I'm going to discuss why I think this problem is well suited and solvable. So why bother studying highly distorted black holes? What do we gain? Well, one of the probably most obvious things is that it is a code test. And this is something that I would say the Albert Einstein Institute has probably done the largest amount of work on with distorted black holes, especially Ed Seidel, Karen Camarda, Steve Brandt, et cetera. So the idea here is that we have these now single black hole codes that can handle a single black hole. In our case, from anywhere to 600 to 8,000 M, where M is the mass of the black hole. But what we'd like to do is start introducing more complexities. So the nice thing about a distorted black hole is that it adds a time dependence. And in this case, it's a time dependence we control. In other words, if I distort a black hole by impinging a wave upon it, I control the amplitude of that wave. And you can imagine that if I make the amplitude small enough, I'm recovering a regime that we understand very well, which is the perturbed black hole, or we can use linearized theory. So we have this controllable parameter to test our code with. And here, then, we can test gauges, how they react to the time-dependent situation, out-of-boundary, wave extraction, formulation, etc. Another aspect of this is what kind of interesting physics can we learn doing a highly distorted black hole? Now, it's very well understood how to do a perturbed black hole when amplitude is quite small. So what are we going to gain by doing something with high amplitudes? And actually, there was a talk on this in this program already on the nonlinear generation of harmonics or modes. In other words, I think so this was work done, there's been two sets of work done besides ours. One was Philip Papadopoulos. Let's see if I can spell it right. Probably not. And recently by, I'm never good at spelling last names, okay. And his collaborators, which are Jeff, Roberto, Luis, Sasha, etc. And he gave a talk. Which one is it?
Never mind.
Oh, yeah, fine. Probably a few other spills. So these guys studied this effect using the characteristic code, characteristic formulation, which Nigel was just talking about, studying, do you really get a nonlinear generation of modes? So there's a question that's arisen. If you look at what people have been doing before when I studied distorted black holes, you can really say I can push my linearized theory pretty far to understand a distorted black hole. In other words, people were basically seeing what they put in. If you put in an L equals 2 pulse, they were predominantly getting out waveforms dominated by an L equals 2. perhaps not that surprising. So Sam Finn keeps bugging people to answer the question, what modes can you generate if you hit your black hole hard enough? Since we can evolve a single black hole in a nonlinear 3D code, what happens if we bang the heck out of the black hole? Do we learn anything new? So this has sort of generated some recent work on this problem. These guys see, well, Philip did about 10% of the mass of the black hole in this amplitude of the wave. I'm not sure how big, how what to say about your guys' amplitude. I wasn't sure how it compared with Philip's. But he saw not too much of an effect, but these guys saw some interesting things, which were large phase shifts. So how do the waveforms, or whatever quantity you're going to measure, change because you've done a nonlinear pulse rather than a small amplitude? And they also saw a larger strength in the gravitational radiation. So they saw some interesting effects that might be attributed to the fact that we now are seeing the nonlinear effects on the gravitational waves. So in other words, if you send in, so say you have a black hole sitting here, and I have a pulse, a gravitation, purely gravitational wave, no matter, that I'm going to send into this black hole, ingoing pulse. And say that I've got, this is just going to be a spherical harmonic of L equals 2, N equals 0. The question is, do you get, as you study that pulse coming back out in terms of gravitational radiation, do you get mixing? So if I started, let's do L equals 4, easier. Do I get, does L equals 4 upscatter and downscatter into 2 and 6? What kind of proportion? What's different than you'd expect from linear theory? So these are the types of questions that you can answer in this picture. And this is the type of thing we'll address as well. Another piece of this problem is I'm going to call it data analysis, or perhaps just looking at the BVH problem, is that when we study the binary black hole problem, we put it into three regimes, right? We say I have in spiral, and I'm going to say that with post-Newtonian. I have the merger. I'm going to say that with mean macro relativity, and finally I have the ring down. And this I can do with perturbation theory. So this is the way we say it, and here we always, this is relatively well under control, except of course the boundaries as well as this. So you can look at the highly distorted black hole as blurring this region, since we are doing full nonlinear codes, but studying basically the transition into the ring down. And this might be able to give us a better picture without having the complete merger. Since a binary black hole is collided, will be a distorted black hole, although how highly distorted we don't know right now. We might be able to connect this picture better than we have just done from doing closed limit studies. This is another aspect of this. And although I guess Chuck and Patrick aren't here anymore, I think something like what they did, in which they studied harmonics in the in spiral to see the ramifications on what's happening to the waveforms in our LIGO and LISA bandwidths, could be an interesting aspect. Okay, so what do we do? First, let me get a little space-time diagram about how we distort the black hole. So how are we going to create a distorted black hole? If I do a space-time diagram where I have a black hole sitting here at r equals 0, an apparent horizon here, mark horizon, and let's keep going. Now we're going to do this in 3D, but let's just pretend to be in one space dimension for a second. I'll need an observer who's going to actually measure the radiation, and at some point out here I'm going to have an outer boundary. So what we're doing is we're sticking a pulse of just gravitational radiation. In our case, as I'll show you in a second, we're going to have a Tsiolkovsky wave on top of a black hole. So we're going to have a black hole sitting here plus some gravitational wave pulse. You'd like it to be purely ingoing. So let's say I'm going to put this at 15 m, and let's say I'll put this guy at 25 m. And I'll make the mass of the black hole.
Solving the exact constraints.
That's right. And I'll mention that in a second. And then, so the question is then, we're going to have this pulse scatter. This is really a scattering problem. and we're going to study what's generated at some observer. And then a question will always be, where have you put this boundary and what is the effects on what you measure? So our approach is to do this with Cauchy formulation and a nonlinear 3 plus 1 code. We're going to solve, as Avi mentioned, the constraints. So we're going to completely solve the initial data. So we start out with a black hole plus a wave, but this is going to be constraint satisfying initial data to arbitrary amplitude in the wave. And we're going to evolve Einstein's equations using the pseudo-spectral code that Larry talked about. And I think this is a very good place to study this problem. And the reasons for that is that, one, this is not an easy thing to do in the Cauchy problem. It's not easy to get good initial data. And so we have Harold Pfeiffer's elliptic solver that's a pseudo-spectral elliptic solver that handles this problem quite well. And so what this initial data looks like, I'll just get rid of that a minute. What this data will look like is, for now, we're going to study an Engel Angular Finkelstein black hole plus what would be a Tsiolkovsky wave if the amplitude were low and I didn't have a black hole. So basically, GIJ, the spatial metric, is going to look like this background metric plus some amplitude by this gravitational pulse. The shape of the pulse is basically just a Gaussian, so it's going to look like x minus x naught over some width squared. Typically, for what I'm going to show you today, I'm going to have x naught be 15m and w be 1. So my width is a little bit small. So in other words, if you took a slice of this of the initial data at t equals 0, if I took a 2D slice and had the hole sitting here, and I'd have some pulse out here in going onto the black hole. So we're going to choose
what element, or what angle depends?
So what this is going to be an even parity, which means the combination of L equals 2 and N 4. And I'm going to show today just N equals 0. Both of those, yes.
So when you solve the constraints, you put in this Gaussian profile as your sort of initial guess, and then you solve for a conformal factor. Does that sort of smear? Does that mean your initial data is your perturbation away from Schwarzschild is not the longer Gaussian?
I think it still shows a Gaussian shape, but it's true. This is initial guess, so we're using the conformal thin sandwich.
Okay.
And you do specify basically this is the free data, and then you do go through the whole process.
Okay.
And it is true that actually, as you increase your amplitude, you do even change the mass of your black hole a little bit. So
okay.
There's
so
there are some effects.
Right.
Conformal thin sandwich.
Yes.
Yes.
And that means your pulse is a limit because there's no wave amplitude in the pulse. There's no transverse k.
Transverse K and pulse. Let me see if I
understand what you mean. Well, you
use
a thin sandwich
if
that's really what you mean.
No, it's not equal to 0. You said it equal to that.
Right.
That's right. You said that. That's exactly right what you said.
But she's right.
You probably have better control to do the angle because of the thin sandwich, right?
Okay. Now, what I can prove is that it's purely ingoing and that, you know, things like that. So it's not. So we probably will have a little bit of this coming back off. And another thing is it might be difficult, even if I put a pure mode in, to really get pure L equals 2 back out again. Things like that. Because we're going through we're applying this crank, which is solving the problem.
Sorry, why did you say L equal to 0, 2, 4? Is it?
Well, if it were a pure Tsiolkovsky wave, even parity Tsiolkovsky wave has a combination of the L's.
But the free data you put into the solver are L equal to 2?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is the black hole cold data?
No. Engel Angular Finkelstein coordinates, non-rotation. We can add rotation, but what I will present today does not have rotation added yet. All right, so the evolution code itself, I'm not going to go into detail. I'm just going to mention some of the things that I think lends itself to the problem. So we're using what's now called the KST formulation. This is a first order symmetric hyperbolic form of the equations. It's parameterized, and these parameters are what's affecting the lifetime of the code. So now I'm using a Kirchhoff black hole code with parameters that a single black hole would last a non-disturbed block hole lasts 600 F. And let's see. And for the case I'm going to show, we're still doing exact densitized laps for people who aren't doing numerics and exact shift. And these are chosen from the single black hole.
I thought you'd be, you're doing conformal consent, which
you would have a lapse given there, but we're not using it. That's good. Oh. Yes, right. It generates a lapse for us, but we haven't used it yet in the
algorithm. And what do you mean by exact?
Exact means I'm writing down a analytic fixed formula, and it's fixed given from the lapse even shift to the get blue factor. Okay, so now this is obviously one of our regions of, as Lee was mentioning just a couple days ago, of active research for our group. But this is what I have in these very, so what I'm going to present today are preliminary results, very preliminary. So one of the things that makes this a doable problem in this code is that because we have multi-domains, in other words, we have a version of fixed mesh refinement. So we can set up our evolution at the start to resolve, to basically have spheres of R where we control the resolution in those spheres. This is how we send our outer boundary. We can send our outer boundary to infinity in effect, but you have to be careful that where you're measuring your wave, you have enough resolution to resolve that wave. The rule of thumb for accuracy in resolving a wave is that you need pi collocation points per wavelength. Just as a comparison, you would need about 20, these are all approximates, to do so in a second order code instead of pseudospectral. So this is the type of thing. So I can send my, in fact, the results I'm going to show you, my boundary is at infinity, but depending on where the last sphere is and how well you resolve here, you can get reflections coming back into your domain, contaminating slightly. They're an order of magnitude less than what we're measuring, but you still see them. But this can be solved by, of course, just making that resolution better. So this is a very controlled situation, and it's also possible today's resources in a reasonable amount of turnover time. So the last thing I wanted to point out is the way we represent our variables. So if I'm going to look at the spatial metric, the XX component, in our code, this is a function of R, theta, phi, and t, and I'm going to represent it as the way the code, because it's pseudospectral, basically, this is what we have. So we have spherical harmonics is how we've dealt with theta and phi. So when it comes to understanding the gravitational or the spherical harmonic content of our data, it's sitting right there. We don't have to do anything to get this information out. We can basically read off the amplitude. So in other words, if I put in a L equals 2 and I wanted to know if I got any L equals 4, it's right here in the data. Now, one of the things you could complain about is I'm going to show you things that are the metric, et cetera. I'm not showing you gauge independent variables yet. And that's another direction we're going to take is to figure out how we really should be presenting this data. But what I'll show you will actually be the variables themselves, and we're going to pick off the amplitudes of the spherical harmonics. So these are very, as I mentioned, preliminary results.
Can I just ask a question?
Sure.
So for the data, what is the maximum amount of relative mass you have in the
So data? As far as the initial data is concerned, what Harold's done so far is to go in a series of amplitudes, starting from, you know, a very small amount, 1% of the mass of the black hole being in the wave, all the way to, well, actually I remember in ADM energy, all the way up to the ADM energy being like 2.8, where the ADM energy for the black hole would have been 1. So considerable amount of energy in the wave. Now the evolution code can't handle that much, so I'm only going to show you up to 10% of the mass of the black hole being in the wave. Okay.
One second, just look at the earlier case, which is 2.8,
mm-hmm.
forgetting about evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, presumably the horizon changes enormously.
What happens is, and I should have brought this plot, what you see is the horizon does change, but what you can do is if I plot the amplitude versus So if I plot the horizon, I'm changing the amplitude, and I plot the AVM energy done on the initial data. The horizon doesn't change as much as the AVM energy does, but it does change. So it is increasing.
So what horizons in the grid is that? You're cutting through the black hole horizon or the white hole horizon?
Black hole. This is a catchy.
That one changes. If you cut through the white hole horizon, then it wouldn't change, right?
But this is the apparent horizon. So I'm going to say the apparent horizon here is at 2m if I didn't have any wave. And what I'm showing you, that does not change very much at all for the smaller amplitudes I'm going to show today.
And the last question about the, you can also monitor the distortion of the horizon, right? Because it's not going to be spherical anymore. It's going to be quite distorted at the initial stuff. But there's no angular momentum because you're putting k equal to 0 in the initial day.
There's no, we haven't yet added any angular momentum.
Still a question on initial data. You said you were using a conformal thin sandwich, and the point of that is you saw, so you choose conformal metric, you choose conformal temperature, and then you're supposed to solve for the conformal factor and the shift. But then, so the force of it is solving for the shift, but then you're not using the shift that you solve for?
We're not supposed to.
Just use that shift to compute Kij.
Right.
Just to involve Gij.
So you are using that shift for the initial data.
That's right. I'm not using it in the evolution. I probably shouldn't even care about that. So when I say this, I mean in the evolution itself, we have to specify laps and shifts as we evolve the equation. So everything's been set up using that laps and shift to create our micro connections and curvature here. And then when we transition,
you start going into that evolution. So the laps you're choosing, it's not giving you maximal slicing, or what kind of slicing is it giving you?
No, it's
not
giving you maximal.
So just some kind of slicing.
Right, I mean, basically the Engle anti-Engle sign. So if you wrote down the solution, this is the elapsed shift you're right, I wrote down.
If you're choosing your elapsed shift based on your original black hole, and then you're adding a mass in the wave, which is three times that, it's maybe not
surprising. No, it's not surprising at all. In fact, that's exactly where, and I'm not going to show that work but right now, but that's exactly where we're sitting right now. I mean, of course, you know that you can't, especially since this width is really tiny. So if you think about what we're doing, we're being almost crazy, right? So you've seen a single black hole, all this energy, and we're banging the black hole very quickly with it, and it's jumping up. And this is the first plot I'll show you.
The mass parameter that looks into the laps and the shift, is it on the isolated black hole?
That's
or
right.
The one
it's the isolated
the,
black hole.
Okay.
So one of the things I've been doing is changing that. I mean, you can predict. So let's talk about that. I think this plot will kind of clarify that. So this is the mass of the parent horizon on the y-axis versus time. Okay. So now this is evolution. So this is 100m of evolution time, where m here is the mass of that original unperturbed black hole. And the little dotted line here, that's a little bit difficult to see, is the AVM energy, as predicted from the initial data. No, we're not computing this during the evolution, which would be an interesting quantity. Okay, so now there's four plots. This is a very small amplitude, 0.001, and you can see what the ADM energy was initially, so obviously really small. And you can also see what the mass of the parent horizon was. Now we're going to increase it to 0.01. There's your ADM energy. And you can see how the mass of the parent horizon isn't changing as much, despite the fact that we're adding not as much as your ADM energy is changing initially. And now we've amplitude up to 0.07. And this is the last case where we can evolve as long as we can evolve a single black hole. Here, when I bring up our amplitude to 0.01, I just put this plot on for comparison. You can see that we're stopping now at 20m. And what's happened is exactly this point. Our laps and shifts are still thinking that the mass of the black hole is 1, and now it's significantly enough changed that it crashes the cloud at this point.
You're trying to think about, you're going to try to plot increasing the width, but keeping the amplitude the same, so that the energy is still a lot of energy in the wave, but it's not sort of lacking it so strongly.
Right. Yeah, I've just started trying those situations right now, but I don't have the information for you as well. But exactly right. So we can increase that width, which is part of that Gaussian shape, so that basically we slowly grow the hole and then adjust things accordingly. And another thing is that I put the pulse at 15m, and the work done by Jeff and his collaborators and Phil had the pulse at 3M, which is random potential. So we can also do that to do some comparison with their results more directly.
Yeah, I mean, we did have the question find that as far as waveforms are concerned, nothing interesting happens until the pulse gets down to around 4 or 3M.
Our concern was is that we wouldn't have as good of an understanding what is actually scattering off the potential and what is really our pulse dividing into and coming back out at us. But I don't have anything that, you know.
But if you want to see the ring down and all that, you have to try to work on the thing.
I don't think so.
We have to repopulate in there.
Well, I don't think so.
But that's when you see the ring down, right?
But you can see the ring down anyway.
Because your pulse is probably, you're probably long enough so your pulse is getting in there, right?
Yes.
So that's why you see it.
Oh, yeah. Because the point is, the reason why I think we can do the problem is we can evolve a long time, or else we wouldn't. Right. That's really what we're after. So, I apologize for using A as my amplitude, my spherical harmonic. I have two things that I call them A. So this is the amplitude, like I mentioned, that we're going to actually be able to read off this amplitude of our different spherical harmonics right directly from the code without doing anything. I'm reading off the L equals 2 M equals 0 case for my observer being at about 24 M. So this is the case where I'm plotting the log of the amplitude of a specific spherical harmonic on the y-axis versus time and evolution time in M. Okay. And for two different cases, I've chosen the smallest case and the largest case where we could evolve for a long time. So what you see here is, of course, the different amplitudes because we have hit the black hole with different pulses. So the black hole's hit. We're sitting in an observer that was farther away than our initial pulse, and we're watching what comes back out at us. And here, I mean, my little joke of quasi-normal reading, we're probably not getting to quasi-normal until down here, and I'm going to show a plot of why I say we are seeing it there. And the question is to characterize this pulse. So what we're looking at is basically the black hole spectrum, and we want to understand what's happening to it. So now why did I stop at 120? The code actually lasts longer than this, but at this point, one of our initial shells that does a log mapping, push the boundary farther away, wasn't resolved enough, and we actually can start to see reflections. You can't see it in the mass of the parent horizon because that's not, you know, this is a much smaller quantity we're trying to measure here, but you actually can see it.
Can you compare this with gravitational results?
You can, yeah. We haven't yet. So one of the things we'd like to do is really start decreasing the amplitude and recover that thing. So that's why so much of this is preliminary. There's a lot we could be doing, and there's no stumbling blocks for doing that kind of thing. It's just a matter of time. So this last plot that I'm going to show is again the exact same plots from previous for the same two cases. All I've done is taken the Fourier transform. So now we're plotting the Fourier transform of that coefficient versus the period now instead of time. And so what you're looking at is what looks like a very broad period here, and these other two here are approximately at 16.8 and 10.36, whatever you expect the first two quasi-normal frequencies to be, but these aren't resolvable enough yet. So this is part of the problem. We need to stick our outer boundary a little bit further away and resolve it better so we can really start seeing the quasi-normal ringing in both of these cases.
Does it get better if you take away the tracking signal just to look at what you think is quasi-normal ringing?
Yeah, you mean just like pretend?
In the time series, when you just sort of take away the first few.
Yeah, so it gets a little, the plot becomes a little bit clearer.
It looks pretty good.
It does look a little bit better. But this is summed over the entire, in fact, this is summed over longer than the 120. This is summed over 300M. So this also has a little bit of that backscatter. But it's an order of magnitude smaller, so you can still see the major effects. So the point here is, to not only recover quasi-normal ringing, I mean, this is the same code that Mark used to do TALS, so it can do it. The question is, how much resources do we have to put in? And this was all done on a single processor. In fact, it was done on one of Penn State's bailiffs. Thanks. So I was stealing their processors to run this code. Because they weren't using them. But anyway, so all this is this is their small one. So. So we can definitely, so that's why it is very preliminary. We were doing this all in single project, so we can do a lot more with it. So the open issues that I think still remain, I don't know, I think probably the characteristic code agrees that they're addressing a lot of the same issues, is to study these salient features of the evolution of the highly destroyed black hole. So what that previous plot, one of the questions is that kind of big transient that's sitting there, you know, is there something interesting there that we can look at that's coming from the fact that we're in the nonlinear regime and we're really destroying the black hole? How generic is something like that going to be? Can we learn anything about what we expect black hole waveforms to be like? One issue that Nils Anderson's always bugging me about is the separation of linear versus nonlinear. How do we know when we're actually seeing a nonlinear effect versus a linear? So one of the things we would like to do is to use a linear code just to check, to make sure that we're really studying nonlinear features. Even though, yes, our amplitude is very high, I think perturbation theories often surprised us by being applicable in a larger range than we might expect. And this is another question, this transition to the linear regime. I don't know how many of you have noticed this or heard talks where people present waveforms, but from what people have done so far, there's an awful quick transition to quasi-normal ringing. So I've seen people, you know, Joel and Crichton, the Lazarus group, AI group, when they show waveforms, they see this awful fast. And so one of the questions is, how generic is this? Is it just because of the initial data they're using, or is there something more to this? And I think the highly disturbed black hole might be a way to look at this in a more systematic way. So our systematic study, higher amplitudes, adding the spin, these are all things that we can do and plan to do over the next few weeks. And that's everything.
Do you see any signs for this photo mixing?
No, I didn't say anything about it. right now, I see the problem is we did this for one set of tests based at one resolution. So one set of resolution. You know, so I haven't done the systematic where you do a large convergence test and try to nail these numbers. So I didn't feel really comfortable saying whether or not we did the same things or not. We don't see anything dramatic, that's for sure. And I'm not studying the phase shifts or things that Jeff from Roberto's paper addresses. So that's...
You should be able to see the nonlinear effects, you know, separate out the linear effects by just varying the amplitude, starting from the small amplitude regime. The output that goes linear in the amplitude, you know, is a linear theory effect, and then the things that go quadratic and cubic,
I agree with that. It's one of those things where, and I spent, the only question will be if we add, so in this definitely, but if I add spin, then I can get some mode mixing, right, with still being a linear effect. So for sure, what you guys have shown and this stuff, we haven't added spin, and so we'll probably find when we see the, and you actually get a power law that you show, right? You get a square.
I mean, it gets roughly the same power law as you'd expect by Clutch Gordon. Around and between the motor coupling.
Right.
Another question I have is, can you tell how much of your initial data contains incoming and outgoing radiation? What fraction is out?
Can to a degree, because I can be an observer at a different location and look at it that way. So by moving my observer for different amounts of time, you can get an estimation of how much is outgoing. I don't have a good number for that yet, but it's certainly much smaller is coming out than going in. It's split.
That's the thing that make it hard for us to compare our results with yours, because we are purely ingoing.
Mm-hmm. So that kind of thing we can definitely get a handle on. And also predict what is the initial spread of after the cell, the amplitude in different modes. We can also predict by being an observer.
Felix studies with outgoing, right?
You can do it either with pure ingoing, pure outgoing, or a definite mixture. You can control it because you're setting your data on those surfaces. In order to make a comparison, we'll have to figure out how to.
Yeah, I think
what
we can do that.
You have.
We just measure it at the beginning.
Do you plan to do something with labs?
Yes, I'm doing labs all the time, actually. I spend an awful lot of time in this.
So what are you looking
for? Two things. One of them is you can imagine still play with specified functions. In other words, I'm going to set the radius of time in the beginning. But I know what that mass looks like at the beginning. So I could start with a lapse of one here. Let's just talk lapse for a second. And then say the lapse of the mass, which is bigger than that, the square of black hole. And that's the studies I've been doing, one set of studies I've been doing recently.
So something discontinuous.
And just blended. Well, I haven't done discontinuous, I've done a blending problem, so you slowly alter. Now, this hasn't worked that well so far, but I really should be studying this for the case that Abai's mentioning, where we grow this with a bit more and a little bit better. So not, this is the most extreme case. And, you know, that's what we're doing right now, is growing this with and then doing the study there. Now, the other thing has to do active gauges. In other words, you specify a PDE for the lapse and shift and then allow that. And we're also studying that case. I have lapses and shifts, not the ones that Lee was talking about, which are very formal, parameterized, respective hyperbolicity. I guess I grew up in the creative engineering camp, so I just wrote down the lapse and shift equations I like. And they can reproduce the 600 single end black hole, but the tests are still preliminary for.
But what are they trying to
do? What they try to do is, see, I'm not sure if they're really well suited for this problem, which is
but
why I was
focusing
on.
PDEs, which you're supposed to do, but.
They're PDEs that we're running out of space on. They're PDEs that basically do this. So if you have the time derivative of a lapse, it's going to be proportional to controlling either. You can have it proportional to the extrinsic curvature and have a driving condition, which you're driving to an equilibrium eventually. So in this case, you can try to force this to be zero, or you can try to force this to end up in the case where you have no more time dependence. You can drive it to the case where you're static. You can play with this, right? You can drive this to different things. Or you can also do this proportional to basically what's called the 1 plus log slicing. So all these are trying to control this type of thing. Now, whether or not this is really going to be useful for the situation where you have such a dramatic change and such a small, you know, you go from being relatively static to relatively static again. I don't know if these gauges will suit it. And this is not necessarily what's going to happen in the binary black hole problem. There will have a slower change.
Yeah.
So whether or not these will be well suited is open question.
Organizers, I guess.
They left you. You can say you ran the whole thing.